Because of introducing the Building Blocks of Hope tool first, or prior to the physician's discussion, I just want to go back and recap and just tie up connect some dots a little bit, so to speak. And certainly I think, as what we certainly know, that myelodysplasia can certainly be a disease of older adults for reasons that have certainly already been discussed. We also have heard that transplant is really the best opportunity for cure. Something, though, that I was certainly reminded of, and that is when it comes to the current therapies today. And as was highlighted, that when we look at azacitidine or Vidaza, that is an agent that has the only survival data in myelodysplasia of the three FDA-approved drugs today. In the high-risk disease setting, it has a near doubling in survival at 2 years. So that is certainly something to celebrate in this disease by folks being exposed to that drug. When we look at reasons to treat, and transfusion dependence is certainly one of them, or if people have symptomatic cytopenias, meaning if people's platelet count is so low that it's going to put them at risk for bleeding, or if someone's infection-fighting ability is so limited that it's putting them at risk for life-threatening infections. None of that will have an opportunity to get turned around unless treatment is given. We certainly have made a lot of strides when it comes to myelodysplasia, especially in the past decade, but those strides have definitely been slow to come. But I think also what we realize today is that through the research that's going on even here locally in your own backyard, research going on at other institutions across the United States, as well as even internationally, you see how people are working hard to improve upon the therapies that we currently have today and really try to find cures for myelodysplasia. And I was also reminded about lenalidomide. And I worked with this drug when it was being looked at in clinical trials. And it specifically has its most robust activity in folks who have a chromosome abnormality or deletion of chromosome 5q, meaning the long arm of chromosome 5 is missing. And so we'll use that as an example here. When people have myelodysplasia, and specifically deletion 5Q, they are red blood cell dependent. I mean, that seems to be the hallmark of deletion 5Q. It's felt that the gene that is responsible for erythropoiesis or stimulation of red blood cells rests on that chromosome. So it's felt that Revlimid or lenalidomide suppresses that clone, which you heard about earlier, suppressing the clone. And as people's blood counts drop on therapy, and we'll use specifically lenalidomide, it's felt that when that suppression takes place, when people's blood counts drop, usually within about the first 21 days of treatment, it's felt that that clone is being suppressed. And actually, if you were to pick up that New England Journal of Medicine article and read about that drug, you'll see that people, 67% of folks, not only achieved transfusion independence, but also folks achieved normalization of their chromosomes. So as that clone was suppressed, people's chromosome abnormality went away and had normal chromosomes again.
Can you repeat that again as it related to you're talking about this
trial? Yes. Specifically that one, but it also has activity in people who do not have deletion 5Q. It's just not as robust. About 26% of folks became transfusion independent compared to 67% who did have that deletion 5Q. But if you look at its FDA approval, it is specifically indicated for folks who have deletion 5Q as a chromosome abnormality, either by itself or with other chromosome abnormalities, with low risk or intermediate one risk disease, transfusion dependent myelodysplasia.
Where was that article?
It was actually published in the New England Journal of Medicine, but it's that's the article that gained lenalidomide its FDA approval. But there's also great articles looking at the utility of IDAZA, or azacitidine, or Dacogen, or decitabine. But the piece that I really want to hit home is that we do have three FDA-approved therapies. Each have their place in the care of patients with myelodysplasia. And keep in mind, improvements can be slow, and people's blood counts can get worse before they get better while on therapy. So it's important to not get discouraged and be patient and recognize that people, as you see your blood counts really plummet on treatment, perhaps more so than just from the disease itself. Mm-hmm. It's important that your healthcare team work you through that.
I get very discouraged sometimes, mm-hmm. based on my blood count going down.
Mm-hmm. Well,
red blood has gone down. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I think what I also understood you to say is that you're going for a repeat bone marrow. Is that correct? That's good to see. What is the status of the myelodysplasia today? And are you someone who can benefit from active therapy? Currently, you're getting supportive care. You're getting supportive care through the use of erythropoietin. You're getting supportive care through the use of antibiotics, but certainly that doesn't change what's happening in your bone marrow. So the question is, when will be a good time to start treatment to try to turn some of that around?
And sometimes I feel like, are they really doing enough, or are they just letting me go down the tube?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the rest of us can help her with this. Tell what your experience has been. When I look at you sitting here today, you look really great. I would never look at you and know that you had myelodysplasia. You know, sitting among everyone, I wouldn't know if you were a family member, a friend, or if you were someone here today with MDS. So when I look at you, you look well. What's important is that, and I think the tool that you have in front of you, the building blocks of hope, can help you become more knowledgeable of when treatment is needed, help you become more knowledgeable of the professional resources that are out there to help, and also help you gain more knowledge for yourself of when you need to ask the questions of when is treatment appropriate. And the fact that you obviously have a local physician who helps with the day-to-day management, which is great, but you also have the partnership of another facility to help oversee your care as well.
When they don't agree on treatments, though, that's mm-hmm. discouraging, too. When mm-hmm. my doctor in St. Joe says something, and then the one that came, you said something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does anyone else have any experience with that? Or
we have two separate, and they get along very well.
Okay.
And they agree with both.
Are they both specialists, oncologists, and
hematologists?
Okay. Yeah, so I think at that point, to listen to both physicians, but at the same time, recognizing where you are. And what your desires are.
Mm-hmm.
That's very good. Very good.
Well, don't you think parents deciding which doctor is the best specialist for them choosing to go with that?
This is actually a good discussion. May I give you this?
Well, I'm surprised that you're having another bone marrow. Have you already had one biopsy?
6 months ago.
Six months ago, and you're doing another.
They want to compare the one from St. Joe to the one in KU.
She was seeing the one in St. Joe, and she wanted a second opinion, so that's why she went to KU.
And to, given how your blood counts are low, and now, as you said, you're starting to run low-grade fevers, I think to get a fresh marrow to see what the status of your disease is today, has it changed over the past 6 months, and make good decisions going forward, is not a bad idea.
Good. Thank you.
Well, I was just saying, I think you should choose, you know, look at the different doctors and decide which one has the most experience.
They both and then, went to school at KU, and they're about the same experience.
Maybe you should come here. Or, you know, make a choice of where.
See, we don't travel that much. We're not travelers, so.
Probably being convenient. I mean, but you're not putting yourself out of a lot. I consider that too.
That's a very good point. It's a very good.
Are there areas of the country where it's more prevalent?
I mean, we're from Arizona, from Flagstaff, and Jim's the only person there with this illness. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the question is myelodysplasia seem to be more prevalent? And you really do ask a good question, and I don't know that I have the best answer for you. So let me tell you what I know. And that is, number one, when I first started seeing patients with myelodysplasia, it was not considered a cancer. So statistics were not kept. At one point in early on, it was documented that there were only like 1,500 cases of myelodysplasia. And today, you know, it's estimated that it's about, can be, according to NCCN, about 48 per 100,000 people that are diagnosed with MDS. Another physician out of Hackensack, New Jersey, had actually accessed the Medicare database and found that folks that carried a diagnosis of MDS, that it was much higher than that. So really, for the first time, true SEER data, or the folks that house cancer statistics, collected MDS numbers for the first time. And of course, it's regional. So one, it's expected that the numbers of folks who develop myelodysplasia is really much higher than the true numbers that we have captured today. When you look at the literature, it's felt that people who have heme malignancies can be more common among rural areas and people like who have been exposed to pesticides. You know, folks that perhaps didn't have good precautions over the agents that they were using. Fertilizers, pesticides, those sorts of things. But really, as far as regional, I do not have any good numbers. I live in Florida, which is a high retirement community. So if you ask me if there's a lot of myelodysplasia in Florida, I have to tell you, yes, I think there is. But is that higher than perhaps, you know, what's in Arizona or higher than what's here in Illinois? I don't have the answer to that. Audrey, based on your experience, do you have any knowledge?
In certain areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know that we do have some states where we don't have any NDS centers of excellence centers. For instance, we don't have one in Kansas, but we have identified the top researchers and centers that had qualified. We don't get those designations easily. But in order to get a second opinion, if it may not be convenient for you to go all the time to an MDS center, travel is too far. A lot of times, even if you go one time, once a year, your local community-based physician determine the recipe, if you will, to have a good quality of life, and let your local doctor carry out the treatment plan.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's about how it is now.
Yeah, and that's really good.
We just are not travelers in lots of traffic, like going down towards Kansas City. We haven't ever traveled a lot, so we're getting kind of old to, like young people can take off anywhere with the, you know, and I hate to say that we're getting old. As far as driving, you know.
It seems like it's an old person's disease.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard that. Yeah, we definitely have heard that. I too wanted to tell you that I've had the luxury of working in an academic center for really the bulk of my career, and I now am working in the largest private community oncology office in Florida, and in a community practice, physicians will see all disease states, so they definitely have expertise in everything. But when you look at the centers of excellence, for example, those physicians there, that's all that they see. That's what they've devoted their careers to. That's what they study in the laboratory. That's what they study through and developing research trials for folks, clinical trials. So the two can work very well together, and that's exactly what I heard, you know, from these folks, that you have the physician close to home who can deliver the care. You have the expertise of an academic center to tell you what they feel is in their best, or to tell you what they feel is in your best interest based on the hundreds or thousands of patients who they see with the disease. But definitely what is important is that everyone's on the same page. So you can have the best of both worlds. The convenience of getting care at in your own backyard with your local oncologist, and travel every once in a while to the academic center, to the center of excellence, to get their opinion. May I give you this?
We just have our blood tests sent to the university, to that doctor.
Oh, yeah.
And we go locally to see our doctor. And so they can coordinate, or, you know, if he can find something out before the other one does, whatever. But we've been fine just staying locally in small town.
Yeah. Well, Parkland Hospital in St. Joseph, they coordinate with Mayo's, but they don't tell me anything, tell me what Mayo's is saying. You know, it's like, I don't even know if. Yeah.
Or while you're at that center getting your bone marrow biopsy and speaking with them, ask them how you're going to get the information from them. Ask them if they're going to call you, that you would like to hear directly from them, and that perhaps that will give you more information to have with the discussion with your local oncologist.
Well, the first time I went to KU, they sent everything to my doctor, and then I got it from him.
Okay. Well, it certainly is appropriate for them to send the information directly. That mm-hmm. piece is critical to your care. But also, I think if you still have a lingering question about what is the outcome of that visit, to request a phone call from them is not unreasonable either.
Mm-hmm.
So you can speak with them directly.
Okay.
And you do get a copy of your blood work
all the time, yes.
But isn't it your right today to ask for, I mean, you can sign and ask for copies of your record so that you can actually see what they're saying. You know, you don't have, that's, today's patient has the rights.
I always get copies of everything.
But you can get copies of their records, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes, though, I hear the scenario that she's saying, that if she's there seeing the physician, she has the bone marrow biopsy done, and then if she doesn't return to that center, then the final conclusion sometimes can be just left, you know, with verbal communication between the two physicians. So I think for you to call and ask what are their final recommendations would be okay.
Good.
Good. So when it comes to managing labs, low white blood cell count, low red blood cell count, low platelets, and living every day, what tips or what pearls do you have to help others in the room, such as managing fatigue, or even as caregivers? What tips can you share with others to be successful?
I think as a caregiver, I think that what's...
Thank you.
I find that Gail will come to me and say, "I'm just really exhausted," and I remember her doing this a couple months ago, and there was lots of things going on in our lives at that time, and I said to her, "You need to think about what you really have been doing." So, possibly you don't necessarily have to write down what you've been doing, but make a mental log of what's going on to see exactly what's been going on in your life. Why are you tired? And have you been sleeping well? Have you not? Have you been doing more things than usual? Are you more active? What stresses do you have that are going on in your life that causes that? And I think that, you know, here, my remark to Gail was, think about what you've been doing. You have been busier than you have ordinarily been. And it was like, oh, yeah, okay, fine, then I'm okay. You know, it kind of went, okay, I'll play that back. So as the caregiver, I believe that you have to, you know, give that support to the person who has the illness, and that certainly would help out. I'm very blessed and am a two-time cancer survivor, and have had people who supported me and you know, say, you know, everything's going to be okay, and here's what's going on in your life. So, you know, whenever you can give back and help the other person do that, it's really, you know, it's really very, very good. So have been there and, you know, would like to give back. So keep that mental journal.
Any other comments? What other questions do you have?
One thing, when I found out I had MDS, I immediately said, I'm not going to have stress in my life anymore, because I was under a lot of stress for a long time. And I just told myself, I can't handle stress. You know, I can't have that because that's not good for me. And I think that's one thing, is to cut the stress in order to feel better.
Well, I was thinking, because I really hadn't thought about things you can do or should be doing, but
we have, like, I think 12 grandkids, something like that. I say that because some are adopted and I don't know if it's final yet. But I think I'm just going to put my foot down about not being around sick people, sick kids, because he's got a cough now, but it's hard to get rid of an infection. And obviously, so I think I'll be more cautious about that, and I'll make him take a nap. Oh, here, take this back. You have anything to say? He really rather just be left alone.
Yeah, adequate rest is definitely important, especially when someone's hemoglobin is not the best. Some days are better than others. I've had people tell me, for example, that to do the laundry is a chore sometimes. To get up and put clothes into the washer, they literally have to go and lay down, get up, and then take the clothes from the washer to the dryer, and then lay down again. So Certainly some days are better than others, and it is important to pace activities. How about younger folks over here? Tell me what you do to be successful in your day in living with myelodysplasia.
Well, he has CMML, which is early stage, and he is a very active person. So having him cut back a little bit is key to managing his infections. Mm-hmm. So he always wears a pedometer, and we kind of watch that to see how many steps do you have today, because if you have over X number, then your ankles are going to start swelling and need to take a rest at that point. So we try to monitor it. It's still we're still learning that process, because he has no other symptoms, really. He's not being treated. He's just wait-and-see stage. Good question. Sometimes he has open wounds that won't heal, and he will go on antibiotics for a couple weeks, and it usually takes 2 weeks to heal, whether he's on antibiotics or not. He ices it, elevates it, you know, tries his, I don't know what you were on. I'm not sure. We have one on hand for any time he gets a little scrape or cut on his ankles, then he's supposed to start taking it. He tries not to. He thinks he can heal himself, but I keep telling him that his body really can't fight it. I know. So that's been a little bit of a struggle to try and protect his ankles from getting infected. And so we've been doing that successfully for a couple weeks now. But when he does... Yes, yes, yeah, so that's the biggest thing. He does have, he had a couple of incidents of night sweats. I don't know if anybody else has experienced that.
They've asked me that, but I've never had night sweats yet.
So, like I said, just wait and see and hope for the best. Hoping he can live with it for a long time.
Night sweats can fall into those constitutional symptoms. That was mentioned earlier. Some people develop it and some don't. Do you have to change your bed linen or your clothing? That's good. That's good. How many folks are on active treatment for myelodysplasia? Okay. All right. Tell me about your experience today and how your life is with treatment versus how it was before you started treatment, if you wouldn't mind sharing that.
Well, personally, I didn't even know I had it. I mean, mm-hmm. There was nothing. The only thing, I was very fatigued, and I still am. Doesn't make any difference what I do. I retired, doesn't make any difference. I'm still tired, you know?
Even so, if you're doing something fun?
Even if I'm doing something fun.
Because, I mean, he feels great. Our oncologist is doing anything you want.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. I've got mm-hmm. the 5q deletion, and I'm feeling good, other than, you know, just very tired all the time.
Yeah. And were you blood product dependent before? Did you receive red blood cells?
Two.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah. And you haven't seen transfusion since? That's really good. Congratulations.
Like I said, I'm very lucky. Mm-hmm. It does not. I'm sorry.
Your white count.
It's my neutrophils are about 11.
Yeah. They were 0.6 when you.
No, 4. They were 0.4 when I was diagnosed.
I've never seen a 0.4.
So
this is a good example of how one of the FDA-approved drugs today can make a difference.
So, absolutely. So,
thank you. How about you, sir?
How about me?
Yes. How has therapy made it active?
Well, I was diagnosed in 2011, November, and I didn't know I had anything wrong with me. And I've had I just finished my 24th session. I get the cetabine 5 days in a row, for 5 days, then I'm off for 3 weeks. So I've just finished my 24th. So I've been on it quite a while. Okay. And the cetabine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I feel great.
Do you have side effects?
Oh yeah, you have.
The question is about side effects.
You know, the first probably 6 months I got sick. I was ill, tired all the time, but with the new drugs today, they give me a shot, or I get intravenously now, but a shot for sickness that takes care of that problem. Another 6 months, I was tired after my treatment. Now I just go out and I live with it. I go do it, and yeah. I find something fun to do. So I go do that, and it's.
So how long would you do this treatment before you do it for 5 days? What do you
mean? Until it stops working.
Until it stops working.
Right. And then it's either a transplant or.
A serenata.
Or whatever we do with it. Yeah, so.
I didn't realize it would continue, so I don't
want
to think that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've asked too. You know, how long is it supposed to go on? And both oncologists, I have too. And
people. Folks can stay on treatment as long as they're gaining benefit, and as long as there are not intolerable side effects. So the thinking is that if you're able to control the abnormality that exists, like that clone, with therapy, and then once therapy stops, then we give that clone an opportunity to come back. People can develop a new normal, as we saw on the graft earlier. Sometimes a white blood cell count may not be totally normal. Sometimes the hemoglobin may not fall within that normal range. Sometimes the platelet count may not fall within that normal range. But it's people still function well without the risk of infection, without the risk of bleeding, and without the need for platelet transfusions, or without the need of red blood cell transfusions. So then there are those folks whose blood counts can fall within that normal range with therapy. With lenalidomide, something that we briefly talked about earlier was iron overload. Each unit of blood contains about 200 milligrams of elemental iron that's not excreted. So it really only takes about 20 to 25 units of blood before people do become iron overloaded, and that iron can land in people's organs, and you can't get rid of it unless people take iron chelators. My experience with Revlimid is an example. In that study, just to tell you how significant this is, people lived with myelodysplasia on the average about 2.5 years before they were enrolled in the clinical trial. The average hemoglobin was like 7.8 grams per deciliter. And with each unit of blood, we hope to raise the hemoglobin 1 gram with each unit. With therapy, with MDS active therapy, the goal is to raise people's blood counts where they no longer fall into that range where they need transfusions or they're not at risk for infection anymore. I have had patients receive lenalidomide where their hemoglobin became normal. In the study, people received an average of about 5 units of blood in an 8-week period. This particular agent with deletion 5q as an abnormality had the ability to raise people's hemoglobin up to 13.4. And I've had patients in my own practice where we've had the ability to take them off of iron chelation drugs and do phlebotomies every month to pull off their iron overload. So if you think about people being that heavily transfusion burdened, and then suddenly they have the ability to donate blood, you know, to get rid of the excess iron and have their hemoglobin still remain normal. So that's a huge, huge stride in MDS care. It's huge. And you think about you know, receiving 24 cycles of decitabine and doing very well with no side effects today. I mean, that's really something to celebrate.
Could you explain what that is? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's one of the three FDA-approved drugs to treat myelodysplasia, and you actually find information about it in the Building Blocks of Hope. But there's three FDA-approved drugs, and as mentioned earlier, someone is taking lenalidomide, which is an analog of thalidomide. Thalidomide is... Yes, that is correct. That is correct. It was definitely responsible for limb malformations and those sorts of things. It was used primarily in Europe, I want to say back in the 60s.
It was the 60s.
Yeah, for pregnant women.
Not very much.
I'm sorry?
It was here used in the United States
right.
for a year, 2 years until. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then a pharmaceutical company brought thalidomide back to life because they recognize its use in cancer care. However, it certainly has been plagued with fetal embryo death as well as malformation of the limbs. Well, but you're right. But the goal is to for thalidomide or lenalidomide, its newer agent generation analog, the goal is to keep those drugs away from people who are of childbearing potential. And of course, you know, it even in people who can benefit from those drugs because it's their utilities in multiple cancers, not just myelodysplasia. There's what we call a REMS program. And where everyone has to be registered. The physician has to be registered to dispense the drug, or to write for the drug, excuse me. The pharmacy has to be registered to dispense that agent. The patient has to be registered today to get Revlimid, you know, making sure that they are aware of the risk of the drug and that they will not let it fall into the hands of someone where it may cause harm. Yes.
It surveys every month.
Mm-hmm.
Was
yes.
it an oral drug?
Yeah. It is. It's a capsule.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. You have to be, they ask questions all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It has to go through a specialty drug. You can't just walk down to your mm-hmm. drugstore and get it.
Correct.
They didn't say, I'm on morphine, so they did the same thing. Yeah. They think I'm going to go sell it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very expensive.
So. Correct, and that's because of that as a known side effect and wanting just to protect everyone's safety. So, and when you think about the routes in which medicines are given today, cancer drugs, swallowing a capsule and it works, or medicines such as the agent you're on, we used to just give it solely IV and people had to be in the hospital to get the drug. Today, you're able to get it in a shot form and be on your way.
Has anyone been on chemotherapy for this? But that is a treatment, but probably not one of the first choices, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, the question is about chemotherapeutic agents. And chemotherapy certainly plays a role in the care of folks with high-risk myelodysplasia, or those folks who have transformed to acute myelogenous leukemia. But today, given the agents that we currently have FDA approved, those, generally speaking, are the first choice because they have a very well-tolerated side effect profile and they can be effective. When someone has developed acute leukemia and they do not respond to the drugs that are currently available, then to move on to chemotherapy can be a next logical choice. And when we think about that, it tends to be agents that we've used for years to manage acute myelogenous leukemia. So it's really is a matter of taking advantage of every agent that's available that can make a difference. But also something that's important is truly not ruling out the role of a clinical trial. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are even after today's presentations. But early on in my career, I used to think, boy, people are guinea pigs, you know, in clinical trials. But you know what? That was me being a young, naive nurse who should have never had that way of thinking, because I see it. And of course, not every clinical trial is for every person. But I have to tell you, if there is a clinical trial that in theory a clinician feels that a patient can benefit from, there's nothing more disheartening if that patient turns out to not be eligible for that trial. So, you know, when folks are doing well with the drugs that we currently have available, that's fine. We know what these agents do. We know what their role is in the lives of people with myelodysplasia. But we also recognize the gaps that still exist. And if you think about transplant still being the only or the best potential cure, we know that Vidaza has survival data. You saw a graft of someone who's been on lenalidomide for 10 years, and the median duration of response for that agent is about 2.2 years. So you have people who can do well for many, many years on the agents that are available. But when you recognize what goes on behind the scenes, like those mutations that were identified through that genomic sequencing, I mean, that is that can really make a difference in how well someone's going to do long term. So if there is a potential therapy that is not FDA approved that someone can benefit from, I wouldn't rule it out. It's a matter of getting the information and having good knowledge if this trial is something that you can potentially benefit from.
Well, the alternative's dying. So, I mean, it's like, why not?
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good point that knowing what we know about this disease, and the majority of folks do die as a consequence of the disease, that if it's right for that person to enroll in a clinical trial to try to turn things around, if it is an option. Yes, ma'am.
Where are the clinical trials now?
Oh my gosh, all over. A great place to look is certainly, when it comes to myelodysplasia, is the Centers of Excellence. And those will be listed on the MDS Foundation website.
The paper you gave us.
And you can log on to the website, because the Centers of Excellence will be listed there. Also, you can go to NIH.gov to see what clinical trials may be available. But also, even in your own communities, there may be clinical trials that are being run through, you know, your own oncologist. But to seek out a Center of Excellence to see what's available, have a discussion with your local oncologist as well.
Is this the Center of Excellence here?
Mm-hmm.
Clinton?
Yes.
And there's one in Omaha, I think.
Yeah, they're all over. There's, I have four in my area in Florida. So there's, but not, some people can travel a long way to reach a Center of Excellence when it comes to MDS care. I just happen to live in Florida.
Where in Florida are you?
Tampa.
There's one in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. So any comments or thoughts? Do you have a different way of thinking about that now? You're going to reserve the comments.
I would just think if he's doing well, why mess with it? I mean,
agree. No, I'm with you.
He started taking something and got sick.
Right. Yeah, think about when people need treatment, when people should start active therapy. And again, what you have with in that binder can certainly help you. So it really is a matter of when people need therapy, knowing what agents are available today and their role, but I would not rule out a clinical trial for someone who needs it. And it really doesn't matter what the cancer is. Someone may potentially benefit from an agent that can make a difference. And that comes from me as a healthcare provider, really wanting the best for people at the end of the day.
Dr. Dispersio, he had a whole different thought on antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
Like that Levitan that they had me on. And the way he talked was, don't start until you have an infection.
Yeah, there's the question is, what is the role of antibiotics in someone who has limited infection fighting ability? And I have to tell you, that's been my experience as well. That I have never routinely prescribed prophylactic antibiotics. We tend to wait until they're needed. And if someone is developing recurring infections, then it may be time to consider what's happening in the bone marrow and possibly provide active therapy. But antimicrobials definitely play a role. I mean, and if someone needs them, they need them.
Well, when I took the 500 milligram Levitin, and I was having no problems except I had MDS and I was tired. Just could go in and go to sleep at 10 o'clock in the morning. But it gave me thrush and it made my food taste terrible. Tendons could break if you took it too long. So, and I couldn't stand the 500 milligrams. So I have the 250, but I just started taking it when I started having the fevers.
Yeah. Thrush can certainly be of a consequence to antibiotics. It happens. It definitely happens. And so we give antifungals for that and clear it up and keep moving. But definitely thrush can affect the taste of food. It most certainly can.
If you didn't have fevers, why would they put you on that?
It's just a different philosophy, that's all. Yeah, it's just a different philosophy. That physician, I'm sure, is trying to do absolutely everything he can to protect someone from getting infected. So it's a different philosophy. I have, there's one gentleman that comes to mind in my practice. He's had mild dysplasia for a number of years and did pretty well until, probably the past year and a half. And his CBC numbers really started to drop. And he has been walking around with a total white blood cell count of, on good days, it's 1,000. Total white blood cell count, 1,000. But his infection fighting ability, his ANC or neutrophil count, tends to run about 200. And on some days, it's 100. And in a year and a half, he has never developed an infection. So he's someone, despite the low numbers, he's still managing to do well. So he's someone who we've not given, prophylactic antibiotics to. And I'm not necessarily saying it's right or wrong. I think it just all depends on the physician's philosophy and what that person is trying to do to protect someone from getting infected.
Somewhere in one of these books it says that a lot of people can live with low count.
That is correct. That is correct. And this gentleman is certainly, he's an example of that. But of course, when you take that and someone who's blood product dependent, and so you have to look at when it really is appropriate to treat, and this gentleman is certainly getting active therapy now.
My GI doctor asked me why they had me on that, and he told me that that could ruin my immune system and my GI area, and he told me to get by Floristor over the counter. It's a probiotic.
Right.
I take it all
the time. Okay, good, yeah. Antibiotics can certainly delete the natural flora in the gut and lead to diarrhea and lead to infections, specifically like C. difficile. So that sounds like he's giving you some good advice as a preventative measure.
Well, he's also the one who sent me to the hematologist in the first place. Mm-hmm. None of my regular doctors, they just kept saying, like there was nothing, my blood count going down.
Yeah. Tell me about you three. You're kind of quiet, if you don't mind sharing. What is your interest in being here today, if you don't mind? So any thoughts on what you've heard today?
Yeah, a lot.
A lot more knowledge.
Good. How about you?
I understood it. It makes a lot more sense to me now. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know exactly what it was. And I guessed based on the meaning of it. Mm-hmm.
So now you know why good hand washing is important for people entering the home and staying away if you have a cold and or sick. Yeah.
I said I shouldn't have any skin on my hands. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is my husband and he's very quiet. I won't say a word.
Yeah. All right. Yes. It's a good question.
But I would just get real tired, like I said, sometimes at 10 o'clock in the morning, I would just have to quit and go take a nap.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
I don't have MDS,
and
I do that.
Mm-hmm.
Twice a day.
I mean, this is really, I had to take a nap.
I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
So, anybody else?
Well, my bucket list has gotten a lot bigger.
Uh-huh.
So I try to do more.
You try to do more,
yeah.
You're checking the list off.
Yeah. So some days you do twice as much, and then you pay for it 2 days later.
Well, yeah.
But But no, I don't.
I keep reminding them we're also getting older. You do less.
How about you?
I really don't do anything different than I did before.
You okay? How about you, sir?
She does. She'll do the best thing.
So how's it changed you with him having myelodysplasia?
I think it's changed. We've had a visit with an oncologist dietitian, and I think I like cleaning my fresh vegetables and soak everything and getting rid of all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. How about you two? If you don't mind sharing, how has having an MDS diagnosis changed your, what do you do differently?
I just gotta be more careful because anytime I nick my lower legs, it's infected. I've had 5 infections in about the last 3 years. So, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it's being more aware, more cautious, but you still weed eat your own yard. So you still live every day. That's it. Any other questions, comments, or thoughts?
Yeah. Jim's the 5Q.
Mm-hmm.
Initially,
mm-hmm.
Is that normal, or is that?
To the expected, or?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So he had a chromosome abnormality that went away with treatment. Is that what you expect? And that's really what you want to see. You do want to see that. Sometimes, though, we don't see that. When reassessing bone marrow biopsies after treatment, it can be better, though. I mean, overall, the bone marrow biopsy itself can be better, but those chromosome abnormalities can still exist. Or some that existed before aren't there. Some may still be present. Others may surface. But it's all about how someone is doing at that particular time. Are they still remain? Are they on the proper treatment? And does that bone marrow biopsy or those chromosome abnormalities trump in deciding therapy? But you definitely want to see if there's a chromosome abnormality that exists that you commonly see in myelodysplasia, and you give someone therapy and that chromosome abnormality is not there anymore, that's an improvement.
I mean, when they said he went into remission, we were very excited.
That's really good.
And then they said, and so we'll continue treatment forever.
Mm-hmm. As long as the therapy's working, because again, the rationale is that if you stop treatment, is what's the likelihood that that clone is going to resurface?
But if you have a transplant, then it shouldn't.
Well, transplant is the best option for cure. So in the most perfect world.
There's only a 40% survival rate after 5 years.
Yeah. I think the comment that was mentioned earlier, and I wholeheartedly agree with this, is that when you're looking for, and you can read in the book as well, that will give you good guidance. But if you're considering going to transplant, or if transplant is something that's being recommended, is to definitely look who in your area has the experience with transplant and go to that transplant center. If you have an MDS Center of Excellence, then I trust that there's a transplant department there because they see patients with myelodysplasia and will take those folks to transplant. So it's a matter of looking at the center, how many transplants have they done in myelodysplasia, and what are their outcomes? I would ask, what are their one-year outcomes? What are their five-year outcomes? So it's about looking to see who the experts are in your area and asking those questions. And again, this Building Blocks of Hope can give you some questions to ask. And the MDS Foundation can also help with that in identifying centers.
Great.
Yeah.
It's been wonderful to have them. Mm-hmm. To be part of their website and to be able to.
Right. Obviously, I'm here because I'm very passionate about folks living with myelodysplasia every day and wanting people to have absolutely the best outcomes that they can have. When it comes to the MDS Foundation, I'm such a huge fan, and not because I'm part of the leadership board, but because of what they do for people. And when you really think about an organization that's pure at heart and doing the right things for folks, this is the organization, and I have a huge appreciation for Sandy Curtin's vision. As I said, this binder truly is the best go-to resource for folks living with myelodysplasia, looking at therapies, asking the questions, empowering everyone, patients and caregivers, to become an active participant in care, asking perhaps what may be tough questions of physicians, getting that second opinion, and really advocating for your care and having a good understanding so you have comfort in your mind of truly what is in your best interest long term.
My doctor at KU recommended that I start taking white blood cell shots.
Mm-hmm.
My doctor in St. Joe says no because he thinks that accelerates it in MDS and AML.
Mm-hmm.
What's your
Yeah, that's a good question. And I am certainly not going to get into the debate over your two physicians. So with that being said, there definitely are subsets of folks who can benefit from Neupogen injections or shots to boost their white blood cell count. The lower risk patients and people who, for example, have refractory anemia with ring sideroblast, those folks getting Procrit by adding Neupogen to that, we see synergy in raising their hemoglobin. And Neupogen shots may be given once a week, for example, with Procrit. So it certainly has its role. If someone, and this gentleman who I used as an example, this gentleman who's been walking around with a neutrophil count of 100 or 200 now for many, many months, he's not had an infection yet. And he is someone definitely with higher risk disease, was asking me about Neupogen shots. And I certainly told him that if the benefit outweighs the risk, I will give him Neupogen. Should he become infected and recognizing his infection fighting ability is very limited, I will give him Neupogen shots to help improve that so he can get over that infection if it's warranted. There is a concern that by giving someone Neupogen with higher risk disease, does that accelerate them going into acute leukemia? And there definitely has been some studies to say no. My experience has been that with people with high risk disease who are on active therapy, in order to keep them on therapy, we may need to give them pulses of Neupogen. Because when someone has very limited infection fighting ability, we're giving them therapy that is myelosuppressive, meaning their blood counts drop further, and they may be slow to recover. So could someone benefit from a little bit of Neupogen then? Maybe. So again, I think that's where for you to look at the experience of the physicians that you have, what is their background when it comes to treating folks with myelodysplasia, who has the greater experience, asking that question of the person who's recommending it, is this going to throw me into full-blown acute leukemia? Ask the question and hear what he has to say. Or does the benefit outweigh the risk? So does Neupogen have a role in people's care with myelodysplasia? Mm-hmm. N-E-U-P-O-G-E-N. It's a growth factor for white blood cells. Just like Procrit is a growth factor for red blood cell support. So does it play a role? Yes. But again, that's where it needs to become individualized and seek out the expert's opinion, ask the right question, and have comfort in your own mind that it's the right thing to do or not.
And that's what I want. That's what I look for. That I'm comfortable with what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Is there a frequency at time that people get a new bone marrow?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
In addition to the frequency, what would be the reason?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Sometimes we can come across folks who do not want a repeat bone marrow. So, you know, we look at their CBC. We may sometimes have the ability to check markers off their peripheral blood, such as their cytogenetics or FISH. Generally speaking, when someone starts a new therapy, to check a bone marrow about 4 months into treatment is not a bad idea. It's not wrong.
But if you're not, I don't do anything.
Yeah, as long as your heme parameters are stable, there's probably no sense in rechecking.
I signed up for some.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. And typically in a study, you're getting looked at with a fine-tooth comb, and that's what they were doing for you. Yeah. So if there's reason based on changes in the CBC, that gives the physician a hint that something just isn't right, that can be an indicator. If someone's on treatment and you want to look at the response of treatment, that's an indicator. Or if someone's doing well on a treatment, to do a bone marrow once a year may not be a bad idea. Or if someone doesn't want a bone marrow at all, then you wait until changes are occurring that warrant it. So there's not a standard answer. And I think Audrey would like to pick up the evals. If you have those ready, we can pass them to the end.
Mm-hmm. That those people who are very experienced, it's not nearly as bad as if you get someone new.
Yeah.
You know, and I think people like this.
I've had four, and the worst one was by a doctor.
I mean, that one was horrible.
Yeah, I hear you. And today, a lot of
it's worth it to ask that question.
Yeah. Right, and a lot of people will have like a bone marrow service, or it can be done under interventional radiology, for example. So they can definitely be done in a variety of settings. Any other closing remarks?
Oh, one is for you to keep. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yes, one is for you to keep. And if you could please help me thank Denise again for coming today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was my pleasure, and I wish all of you very, very well. And if there's anything that I can do for you in the future, please do not hesitate to reach out.
I would love to visit Florida.
Please do. And I want to come to your family reunion. Yes. Yes, that is correct.
Since my white count is so low, it would give me more chance of getting an infection if I get this bone marrow biopsy next year.
That has not been my experience, no. We do bone marrows with low platelets, low white blood cells. Is it a risk? Yes. But again, my experience is not. But they'll help you with that.
The first one.